This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. Night School on BFM 89.9.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and concepts to best understand how society works. Each week, Fuad and I will lead a discussion on a concept or a classic text, which we hope will shed light on the world around you. This week, Fuad, you have the mic again.
Well, I've been thinking a lot about doing Nietzsche for the show. And in fact, last week I prepared notes to discuss his famous claim about the death of God. But as I was compiling the information, I realized that Nietzsche is so enigmatic, so full of mystification about his reputation, that I felt that maybe before getting into the death of God, which is fascinating, we could take a step back and consider some of his more general ideas. And one way to get to those ideas would be to discuss his other interesting concept called the eternal return. So this week, that's what we're going to talk about.
I think Nietzsche is probably one of those philosophers who finds his name on T-shirts more than most, yeah?
Yeah.
And tell us a little bit about the man.
Well, he's best known as a fierce critic of religion. He was most active in 19th century Germany when Europe was modernizing, and there was this huge paradigm shift that the continent was going through from the so-called pre-modern era that was supposedly more religious, more traditional, to the so-called modern era that was more progressive, more scientific, and
more secular.
So he witnessed these changes, and in many ways his philosophy was conceived in response to that shift.
He did have a very religious upbringing. Wasn't his father a clergyman of some sort?
He was a Lutheran priest. His father was a Lutheran priest. Nietzsche himself was exposed quite significantly to religious education in his adolescence. And in many ways, I think, and many biographers of his life and works would agree, his philosophizing was in reaction to being really immersed in religious life.
Right. So he lived a rather short life, I understand, but he died about age 56. And
something like that, yeah.
In 1900, yeah. Yep. Okay, so we're talking about the eternal return of the same.
Hmm. Yes. The first time I ever heard this phrase, it kind of harked to, you know, the German hair metal bands, the eternal return. I don't know why that it just conjured that image. But anyway, more to the point, the eternal return, or like you said, the full phrase, the eternal return of the same, is basically a thought experiment Nietzsche proposed to make us wonder, what if our life now will repeat itself? What if after death, we go through this life all over again? That everything we've been feeling, the highs and the lows and the good and the bad, we will feel in repetitious cycles. So effectively, this would mean your current life ending and then starting where you started before. And this goes on over and over again.
Now, this sounds suspiciously like reincarnation that, you know, older religions, Buddhism and Hinduism, have. Is it the same?
I'm not too familiar with Buddhism or Hinduism, but what Nietzsche is trying to get at here is not another chance at life. You don't get a blank slate in the next cycle. So he's not saying that you can do it better the second time around. What he's really asking is, what if you will live this exact same life you're living again and again and again and again, and you have no choice to change it later?
Okay, right? So it's not reincarnation where you perhaps can earn karmic points and do better the next time.
No, nothing like that.
And it's not Groundhog Day either.
It is a little bit like Groundhog Day.
Oh, it's more like Groundhog
Day. It's more like Groundhog Day in the sense that, let's say if you and I were to, you know, somehow be resurrected in this cycle of eternal return, we'd have this exact moment right now.
Right. So Groundhog Day is when you wake up the next day and you realize at some point that you've actually done it before, that this day is actually what yesterday was just like.
Exactly. But this is like, to take the analogy, this would be like Groundhog Lifetime.
Oh.
Yeah. So every day in your lifetime is repeated over and over again. And Nietzsche wants us to think about this. Right. Nietzsche wants us to really think about it seriously. So it's not a riddle with a set answer. It's not an IQ test one can solve. He wants us to really confront the possibility of having to live our existence over and over again. In fact, I go so far as to say that he wants us to be terrified at the thought of an eternal return.
And why is that?
Basically, the idea behind this thought experiment is for us to confront our present. That if we start seeing this existence as repetition, that this exact moment will repeat again, we will seize life. We will decide to live the way that is best for us in the here and now, rather than later. So what Nietzsche has in mind is a thought experiment to make us confront the present, to really see what we're going through every day in our lives, and see if this is something we can experience in repeated lifetimes.
Now, okay, what is the status of a thought experiment in philosophy? And is this something we can all actually engage in?
Well, Nietzsche would certainly hope so, because his larger project depends on us grasping the significance of the eternal return, right? So say, for example, you don't like your job and you wake up every day doing this job you don't like from 9 to 5, sometimes earlier and ending later. And you always do this for some idea of a future. You know, you want to save a certain amount so that you can do X. You want to do this so you can scale the heights of your corporations or something like that. And you go through this robotic process every day over and over again. And because you're so immersed in it, you never really pause to ask if there's something you really want. And what Nietzsche would like us to see through this thought experiment is to say, hold up, can you see yourself living this sort of life over and over again? And if this thought experiment is done properly, he would think that you would stop submitting yourself to this process of joyless labor and do what you you really want. So that's sort of what he's trying to get at.
Okay, okay. Yeah. So at one level, it sounds a little trite. It sounds something you might read in a Hallmark card, right? You know, live today, you know, like you'll never live before or something like that. Something, you know, inspirational and, and you know, heartwarming. And, you know, is that what he really means by this?
No, that's not what he's trying to get at all. And this is where we go a little deeper into how he's using this thought experiment. Nietzsche is not just saying seize the day. He is saying seize life. He's calling for something more profound than just looking at the bright side of things or pursue your dreams, right? Now, what does that mean? For a sense of this, we'll have to look at Nietzsche's critique of Christianity, a critique which the eternal return essentially presupposes. Consider in particular the Christian conception of time that Islam also in many ways assume. For one, both religions regard time as linear, as a straight, never-ending line, the opposite of cyclical time that the eternal return assumes. We see the straight line of time in Islam and Christianity, for example, in their more fundamental claim that this existence is temporary. In fact, it's even less than temporary. Come to think of it, Islam and Christianity claim that this existence is really just a speck, a dot, a minute in the larger unfolding of time towards the afterlife where we finally experience eternity after Judgment Day. For some, hell is the interval in between. But for those who have been nicer in the previous life, they go straight to heaven. And then time just continues on and on and on. This is linear time that both religions operate on. Now, Nietzsche is uncomfortable with this scenario because what it effectively asks us to do is to judge the present in terms of an ideal future. In this outlook of time, in Christianity and Islam, the present is really just devalued. Our happiness here and now doesn't really matter because there is an afterlife that we have to look forward to, after which we can finally exhale and then do what we want. Again, note how this is the opposite of the eternal return scenario which Nietzsche wants us to consider, where life doesn't proceed in a linear line, but as repeated cycles.
Now, okay, the cyclical notion of time is in other religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, right. But there is this other thing about the linear sense of time that is so much part of the modern way of thinking about time, isn't it? The future orientation is not something we have just in religion. We also have it in political ideologies, and we have it very powerfully in the notion of progress, that with time, progress will come. And perhaps we even have it in very domestic settings. You know, people are invested in the future through their children. They believe, you know, they make sacrifices today for the lives of the next generation.
Correct. And Nietzsche identifies these tendencies to to project the head that you mentioned is much the hallmark of modern life, where we see the future as more hopeful, more redeeming. And he applies that criticism with equal force to so-called secular ideologies such as socialism and even the idea that science is inherently progressive.
Right. So this critique is something that we can apply beyond religion.
Correct. Although Nietzsche spends most of his time directing it to the religious life. So just to solidify our understanding of this religious conception of time, we shall take the example of the hypothetical deferential third wife of a polygamous Muslim marriage.
This example, this woman keeps appearing now, sure, yeah. Doesn't she?
Yeah, we should have her on in sometime to hear her side of the story. But I think, you know, it's an extreme example, but it brings out the point that we should consider for the thought experiments that we normally have. So the hypothetical deferential third wife. Let's just say she hates that life. She doesn't like being treated like a second-class citizen in her own home. She resents having to take turns with other co-wives, but she nonetheless has to swallow her pride and accept it all because she knows that this is the way to go to heaven. So her suffering in this life is redemptive for another time in the future. So if we were to apply the eternal return thought experiment to her case, she will have to ask herself, what if time wasn't linear and that her existence now will have to be repeated over and over again? Can she bear the thought of being a third wife of a polygamous marriage in an endless repetitious cycle? A proper meditation of that possibility, ideally, would frighten her. For even the thought and image of having to repeat the degradation over and over again would repulse her. Thus, the eternal return, grasped properly, would propel her to say, no, enough, I'm not going to accept this, I'm going to break free and live life. So turning the perspective from viewing life from a supposedly certain future to instead viewing life in the uncertain present is what eternal return wants us to do. So to be clear, Nietzsche's critique of the religious outlook just isn't a reaction to religious laws, right? He's not a simplistic liberal in that way. He's not just saying, religion, leave me alone. What he is ultimately calling for with the help of the eternal return is the affirmation of life. The thought experiment wants us to cultivate in us the realization that our existence in the present is in fact valuable. So going back to the example before, the reason why the third wife went through all that hardship was because she had assumed that life now isn't really the point. That it's not worth living to the fullest today because another realm of eternity, of real existence, awaits us after we die somewhere else in the future. And that's the attitude that Nietzsche really wants to combat.
Now, isn't there also in the idea of sacrifice something of this, that we do things sometimes that are not pleasurable, that don't, that we defer gratification really in order to achieve something better in the future? Would that be something that Nietzsche would be against?
No. What he wants to address is our attitude to sacrifice. And sometimes the tendency, and religion, he believes, encourages this tendency would be to think that the sacrifice is merely instrumental, that there's no real inherent value in pain and striving, because ultimately what we're aiming for is a time elsewhere. What Nietzsche is calling for, and which we'll talk about soon, is to see the value in sacrifice, strife, and pain in itself. Yeah. So rather than to suspend that and hope for redemption in this vague afterlife, Nietzsche wants us to come back down to earth and see that struggle as virtuous in itself for its own sake.
We are talking about Friedrich Nietzsche and the notion of the eternal return of the same. I'm Sharad Kutin with Ahmad Fuad Rahman. This is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is Night School. I'm Sharad Kutin with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. We're talking about Friedrich Nietzsche's notion of the eternal return of the same. Do you want just to do a bit of a recap on what you just said?
Sure. So the eternal return is basically a thought experiment Nietzsche proposed to ask us, what if we were to live this exact same life over and over again? Not a reincarnation to a new blank slate of life, but this exact same life, feeling the exact same highs, the exact same lows, the exact same joys and pains over and over again. The idea is to get us to confront what we do every day and to make us really ask if this is something we like to do, or we're just buying time in hope of getting to some vague future.
Right.
And the main target of this critique is religion, because for Nietzsche, religion denies the pleasures of this life, the wonders of this life, for some promise in the afterlife.
Right. So, and the one thing that you also ended with in the first part was that in many ways the notion of sacrifice in a religious outlook is an instrumental notion, mm-hmm. that it's only a tool to get somewhere, and that is the afterlife. Whereas you're saying Nietzsche is actually asking us to find value in the sacrifice, in the hardship, and see it.
Correct. See the value in sacrifice, going through the hardships of life for its own sake. Which effectively means embracing life, affirming life.
For many people, I guess, having a notion of the afterlife is a way of dealing with present difficulties, right? And so if you remove the possibility of a reward or even punishment, you want bad people to be punished. If they're not punished in this life, I'm sure hope exactly. they get punished, you know, in the afterlife. What is left for us? I mean, is it a world now robbed of meaning? I mean, is it robbed of a sense that meaning can be given to it because there will be justice, as it were, in the end?
There are many reasons why we would think that the religious option is compelling, and Nietzsche understands that. When you read him closely, you really realize that his attitude to religion is more nuanced than what people say. He knows clearly that life is difficult. It's harsh, it's lonely, uncertain, daunting, it's expensive. And in being overwhelmed by all that, it is always too compelling to just ignore the present, to ignore this world, and aim for another future. And oftentimes, that future has translated to the kind of future that religion promises. It tells us that it's okay to lose out in this world because another world awaits us. We're told that that's when life finally becomes fair and justice is finally served. For Nietzsche, this is very nihilistic because you're essentially denying the value of what is in front of you. You have life in the present, and yet you push it away, hoping, yearning for a more complete existence of judgment and redemption in an afterlife. And there is something that Nietzsche finds very sick about that. But with the eternal return, the idea that you have to relive your choices in various cycles of the very same existence over and over again, he hopes that will make us realize that ultimately what we want is an attitude that affirms life rather than rejects it. So let me give an example of a friend I know. He's Malay Muslim, and he dated a Christian Chinese. So what started out as a teenage romance soon matured into a full-fledged relationship. They truly loved each other in profound ways. After years, as they grew closer, far into adulthood, they realized that a decision had to be made on whether or not to continue with the relationship. Marriage was something both of them wanted, but they were also somewhat connected to their faiths, even though they were not necessarily pious. They both want their kids to grow up exposed to their respective religious traditions, and they both harbored some hopes of reconnecting with the religion later in their lives. So after more years of not coming to a solution, they decided to make the very painful decision to break up and find a partner of their own faiths. The process was grueling. They had to cut ties with each other's friends and families, throw away all the gifts they gave to each other and all that. Nietzsche would again say that this is nihilistic. This life has revealed to them their capacity to love profoundly, which they both embraced at first. It transgressed their provincial cultural and religious sensitivities, but it was in their anticipation of another life, an afterlife which their religions promote, that they had to eventually deny the blessings of what this life revealed to them. They downgrade the true force of the experience they have here, in the moment, in light of an expectation of some vague afterlife.
What about someone who would say, well, you know, they were just being realistic. They understood that they might become more pious in the future and that this would now become a struggle because one of them would have had to give up their own religion. They would, you know, then be living in a kind of in a bad faith. They would be, you know, living a kind of hypocritical life, you know. So wasn't that just being sensible and realistic?
One can look at it as a sensible and realistic choice, but what Nietzsche would, I think, bluntly say is that they were nihilistic. They were weak in that sense because they already had the strength to go to power through that much, and they already had the strength to look into each other for the true individuals they were and love each other despite of their social categories and prevailing conventions. And this was revealed to them through life itself, right? There was no angelic revelation that zapped into their minds to kind of nudge them closer to each other. This was brought to them because of their own paths in life, and they denied it eventually because of religious attachments.
Okay, so they were cowards essentially. They refused to take the more difficult path, perhaps, and they kind of shrunk away. And you know, in the words of Jean-Paul Sartre, they kind of maybe blamed others. They said, "No, society expects this. My families expect this."
Exactly.
You know. So okay. I'm trying to get the hang of this.
Yeah.
He's much more interesting than, you know, when you first kind of encounter the idea. It just seems like it's a kind of silly experiment.
Yeah.
But anyway.
There are a couple of other examples, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And they're milder forms of this. Maybe this interfaith love is a bit too extreme. But so, for example, say, and this is something that I experience among my Muslim friends. They walk into a Christian church, like a Catholic church or a Hindu temple, and they can't help but to be impressed by the architecture, by the iconography. And they're like, wow, this is kind of neat. But, you know, as they appreciate it more and more, half an hour into it, they realize, well, it can't be that cool because they're not Muslims, you know? So it can't be that cool because they are in the wrong faith. And what the impulse to kind of stop that moment of appreciation in the present is this nagging feeling that you have that ultimately you'll be judged in a different time. So the beauty that you absorb in the present, you just have to kind of, you know,
deny
at that moment, because you somehow have this hope for redemption after life, which is really vague at the end of the day, right? So that's nihilism, because you see the wonder, you see the beauty, even though it's a different faith, but you nonetheless deny that because you believe that time is linear, you know, and you believe that there's going to be this eternal life. So
when Nietzsche was making his argument, who was he addressing? What was he hoping they would do? Was he expecting people to just throw away their religious beliefs, you know, stop believing in a future? And often when people do that, they actually substitute it with something else.
Yes, and I think we're going to get to that soon. But, okay, if we have time, I can mention a little bit about what his problem really was. His problem, and again, let's get back to his context. He was addressing Christianity, and his problem was not so much with Christian myth. He wasn't like Richard Dawkins. He was an atheist. It wasn't Dawkins-esque kind of atheist who, you know, looks down on people of faith. It wasn't quite like that. For him, the problem was with the notion of guilt that Christianity had elevated to a kind of ontological status, right? I guess this is where Christianity differs with Islam. For Islam, guilt is determined in that moment of choice, of choosing particular action. But in Christianity, it has deeper connotations, right? It assumes a kind of narrative about original sin. There's something about your soul that is corrupted. And this, Nietzsche believes, was the engine that drove the kind of nihilism that Christianity bred. And what he wanted really to target was that. Not denying a future, that's not at all, but denying life. And he believes that once you affirm life, you even have a better sense of the future. You're not so daunted by it. There's a lightness in your attitude to it, rather than seeing every day as this chore to get through before you get to the end.
I mean, as a kind of lapsed Catholic myself, it's so lapsed I'm an atheist.
it's pretty lapsed.
Yeah. I do understand this idea of guilt. You know, and I do understand how gripping it can be on the psyche.
Nietzsche identified the outlook it produces. That's very bleak, he thought.
For people who believe in religion, how do they endure life without it?
So for Nietzsche, rather than to transfer our strength to hope in an afterlife or an ideology even, he invites us to find that strength in ourselves. And this hints to another famous Nietzschean concept that we've probably heard at some point, and that is the will to power. What that will is really about, to explain it quickly, is just that, a will to affirm life. So rather than turning our heads up in the heavens in prayer, we confront the world as it is, in all its ambiguities, all its harshness, and find the strength within us to trudge through all its imperfections, and in that process, appreciate the vulnerability in our struggles.
Wow, that's a very difficult embrace, right? It's you're kind of having to embrace pain. You have to embrace what we all, in many ways, strive to run away from.
Exactly. But this is where Nietzsche is interesting, because there's a very particular take on pain.
So would you have to see pain over and over again if you live the eternal return?
Not exactly. But to understand why, we have to look at Nietzsche's conception of life as a work of art. And what this conception aims for is not a moral life necessarily, so much as a beautiful life. And what this calls for is a desire to see existence as a constant process of creativity, in that we appreciate otherwise odd, unpleasant, and incompatible parts of life to weave them into an inspiring synergy. Put simply, Nietzsche calls us to confront the good and the bad, the boring and interesting, the passive and active aspects of our life, all in equal honesty, and to see how they interact and enrich one another. Let me give an example. We've all at some point mourned the death of a friend or someone we love. It is always difficult in the beginning. The absence is nothing that we can bear without some suffering in a real sense, suffering that should not be devalued in any way. But time passes, life continues, and we take on other challenges. None of these necessarily eases the earlier pain of loss, but as we age and take on more of life, we gradually become more able to look back to the past differently. For example, we may still naturally miss our friend more and more over time, but in that missing her more and more, we realize just how much it is we're capable of loving, that we bear more space to feel than we initially thought. And in that mourning too, we may understand love more, that perhaps love is not just about possession so much as it is about relinquishing, surrendering, and accepting our vulnerability. And in that, we may also learn to appreciate the presence of our living friends and loved ones in a more profound way than before. Anyway, the point is that all that learning came from life itself. It was through pain that we found strength, and through absence that we saw love in a greater light. All that came from the fact that we decided to embrace life and continue, and to reflect deeply in the process. In that example, life, even the pain it produced, was the raw material out of which our personality was sculpted. And life is not all pain, he makes that point. Sometimes it's how we orient our worldview, that there's always, nothing is always all or nothing. It's not all pain or all joy, right? It's always finding a creative balance into it. And it's producing a certain outlook on life out of a realistic confrontation with life's complexities that Nietzsche is asking us to do.
Is this, you know, it's very interesting, but there's echoes of Eastern philosophy, like the Tao, like, you know, the golden mean, you know, harmony.
That's the thing. Nietzsche is not off. It's not for harmony or the golden mean. He likes chaos. He likes ambiguity. And harmony and finding the golden mean assumes a kind of stasis. But what Nietzsche is going for is something more avant-garde, something more experimental, if you talk about art, you know?
He wants us to embrace the dark side, as it were.
Yeah, embrace, but take it by the horns, you know? Not let it tarnish us. If you have a canvas and you have to paint, there'll be dark colors. And the goal is not to avoid dark colors, but to know where to put it. So it's not so much an avoidance or a submission even to the dark side, but to wrestle with it and know where to put it and do it elegantly and find the beautiful life, so it were.
Why is it that it's beauty, not truth?
Because truth has been for the longest time the property of religion. And what religion also does for the longest time is to say that truth is not here, it's elsewhere, it's in the afterlife. That this is all fleeting truth, that it's all conditional upon social context or life here, that is not divine enough. So truth, often capital T truth, has been taken up by religion or ideology. And for Nietzsche, that is again an evasion of life. He wants us to come back down to earth and wrestle with all the ambiguity and make something of ourselves out of it. So the best analogy for that is art. Is mixing otherwise incompatible or odd parts of stuff or colors or instruments into something, you know?
That's something we must come back to at some other point.
Sure, sure.
The fact that he kind of lands in the aesthetic rather than on the question of truth.
Yeah, and much like a painting will combine complex and different colors, or a song would fit in different instruments into a harmony for a melody with different parts, this is the same attitude to life Nietzsche wants us to take, so that we see the challenges and blessings of life as ingredients to find it beautiful. For let's not forget that a sad song can also be beautiful. We can really enjoy it, appreciate it, delve into it, despite the melancholy lyrics and slow rhythm.
beauty need not lie only in bliss and pleasure. Inspiration may come from the worst of times, but with life as a set of colors, our strength as the brushstrokes, and time as a canvas, we can come up with something beautiful at the end of the day. And if that is what you can look back to and accept for the hypothetical eternal return, when this life is lived in the exact same way over and over and over again, then you can be proud and say that you truly did affirm and seize your existence when you could.
So was reading the Gay Science, was it pleasurable? Is it poetic? Is it an easy read?
No, it's not an easy read. In fact, Nietzsche is never an easy read because, for the most part, you are bringing with you misconceptions about him that you heard from somewhere else, that he was a nihilist, that he was, he was just a polemicist, he wasn't a real serious thinker. So you got to be patient with the guy. And the other reason is because of the style in which he wrote it. He wrote in aphorisms. He didn't write like a typical philosopher would in terms of treatises or systematic statements. So they were, and it's sort of like a painting. There are some aphorisms are longer than others. There's comedy interlaced with serious, deep reflections. And he plays with ambiguity. He plays with symbolism. He provokes you. He takes jabs at Christianity a lot of times. So it really is a test. But I think from that experience, you start to realize what he's getting at. He wants that sort of back and forth with circumstance, you know, and he wants you to think about that very seriously as a reflection of what life is like. You know, it's like a chess game. All you can really know is your next three or four steps. The rest, life will just, your opponent, or in this case, life will just present you, and you will just have to improvise. And hopefully you do it gracefully rather than, oh, I'm going to run away. Let me find a mosque somewhere. Let me pray to God. You know, you take it by the horns and you live. Right. And but, you know, I hope I don't sound very anti-Islamic in this podcast, because a lot of Muslims have engaged with Nietzsche as well. Iqbal took Nietzsche's concept of the Übermensch very seriously. And Übermensch is one, the man who affirms life. And he thought that the life affirmation that Nietzsche presented is something that Muslims must think about more.
That's another show.
Perhaps, yeah.
One of my favorite quotes from Nietzsche, which I used to have on my notebooks, was when reading the classics, bring along your mind.
Yeah, I think that's... Because that's one thing he found in scholastic life, which was this deification of authors, you know, idolizing. That's another term he uses a lot, idolize, the idol. And how we... Because life is so overwhelming, we often just... surrender to idols, you know, so.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Fuad. That was fascinating. You've been listening to a discussion about Friedrich Nietzsche's notion of the eternal return of the same. Now, Night School will be on again on Wednesdays at 9 p.m. You can hear a broadcast of it, but it's also available on podcast. You can get in touch with us on our Facebook page.
BFM Night School. Email us too, bfmnightschool@gmail.com.
We've already received one email.
Yeah.
We have about 150 likes so far on our Facebook page. That's very encouraging.
That's a good start.
Yeah, we're always looking for feedback, criticisms, comments, ways that we can do the presentation better. So we look forward to hearing from you. Mm-hmm. I'm also available on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @SharadKutin. Fuad, do you have a Twitter account?
Not yet.
He's been promising for weeks. One day. So that's all we have for you this week. I'm Sharad Kutin with Ahmad Fuad Ramad, and this is Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.